Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to this afternoon's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. The program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series. It's underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation, devoted entirely to literature and to memoir. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Brian Hackney, science editor and host of Eye on the Bay for CBS 5 in San Francisco. And it's my pleasure, real pleasure, to introduce our guest this afternoon, Simon Winchester. I was first, probably like you, introduced to Mr. Winchester not in person but in print by way of The Professor and the Madman back in 1999. And when somebody has a background in geology and then veers dramatically off into a course in journalism at the age of 21, a career that's taken him everywhere from Watergate to a prison in Tierra del Fuego, and when his nonfiction ranges from the Oxford English Dictionary to the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, to Krakatoa, I say, come sit by me. This is a man you want to spend quality time with in whatever fashion you can. He was made an officer of the Order of the British Empire in 2006. He was also Britain's Journalist of the Year. Presuming that he ever goes home, he lives on a small farm in Massachusetts and also in New York City. And today, the Commonwealth Club could not be more pleased to have him hold forth on his newest book, Because It Couldn't Write It Itself, a biography of the Atlantic named Atlantic. Ladies and gentlemen, Simon Winchester.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's lovely to be here this afternoon. This book was born in two senses, essentially out of the Pacific Ocean, even though it's a book about the Atlantic. And it was born in a general sense and in a specific sense, and I'll describe both in sequence before I tell you a little story. In the general sense, it was born out of a failure of a book that I wrote about 20 years ago about the Pacific when I was living in Hong Kong. Everyone told me at the time that the Pacific was clearly the ocean of the future. And so I got so sort of tired of people telling me this that I thought, oh, well, I must write a book about it. And so I spent a couple of years traveling everywhere across the Pacific from sort of Kamchatka in the northwest to Chile in the southeast and from Australia up to Alaska and all the islands in between, and wrote a book, which I think was published in at the end of the 80s, I think, which was a dismal failure. And believe you me, I know failure because I wrote a book about the American Midwest once in the 70s, which sold precisely 12 copies. Although apparently on eBay I was told that it got a 13th sale quite recently. So, but when we sat down sort of licking our wounds and thought, why did the Pacific fail so badly? It was obvious to me that the reason was that although the Pacific might well be the ocean of the future, what it clearly wasn't was the ocean of the past in terms of the human story. Yes, you had the Polynesian navigations, and yes, you had Magellan and Captain Cook and people like that, but not that much else. It wasn't a particularly important ocean in the human story, not least because there was, of course, the land bridge across the Bering Strait, and most human migration took place across there. So basically what I realized was that I had chosen, I'd backed the wrong horse, as it were. And so thinking about this a little more, it became evident that in terms of bodies of water that were involved with the human story, the Mediterranean was clearly the inland sea, if you like, of classical civilization. And if you took that as a starting point, then it wasn't much of an intellectual leap to think that the Atlantic Ocean next door could probably justifiably and rightly said to be the inland sea of modern Western civilization. And so born out of the failure of the Pacific book, I thought that one day, if there was an opportunity presented, I would try and write a book about the Atlantic Ocean. Well, other ideas came and went, and other books came and went. And then the trigger that prompted me actually to, as it were, get on the horse, the right horse this time, I hope, came about 5 years ago when I was on the Pacific, again, oddly enough, in southern Chile. I was driving up the road, which I dare say many of you might have done, the road from Punta Arenas in southern Patagonia in Chile, up to the Torres del Paine National Park. And it's a very bad road, a gravel road, very windy, with virtually no human habitation. And it was on this particular night, very, very stormy. I mean, there was a very, very dramatic thunderstorm, lightning storm, rain. It was very difficult to see anything. And I was tired anyway. It was 9 or so o'clock at night, pitch dark. And I thought, I must stop. I must pull off the road. And there were no villages or anything, but there was a road off to the left with a little wooden sign which simply said, Hostería del Río de la Penitencia, which didn't look terribly promising, I must say. But nonetheless, I thought, well, you know, what the heck? And I'd been in prison in Patagonia before, so I knew what to expect. And I turned left and bumped down this absolutely execrable road, and at the end found what appeared to be a huge Scottish castle, and with a few dim lights on inside and a great oak door. So I hammered on the door, and a functionary opened it, and I said, are you? And he said, yes, yes, we're a hotel. We haven't actually had a guest here for the last 6 months or so, but you're more than welcome. And he explained a little of the history, that it had indeed been opened by a Scotsman in the 1880s, and he had raised sheep there. And they no longer raised sheep, but instead they raised the Chilean version of the llama, which is, I'm sure, what you all know, an animal called the guanaco. And the guanaco apparently is extremely tasty, and so he had a guanaco steaks or things in the fridge, and he said, I will make you a casserole of guanaco and bake you a loaf of bread. And so I sat down at the kitchen table with this terribly nice man in this baronial castle, eating casserole of guanaco and freshly baked bread and a couple of bottles, or one bottle, I should think, of Malbec, and felt really happy. And then he showed me into the library, which was a magnificent room with a huge sort of inglenook fireplace, great baronial structure, bottle of whiskey, roaring fire, and a library all of English language books. And I couldn't have felt that I was more in heaven. I just thought this was absolutely wonderful. So I plucked a book down from the shelf and sat by the fire and poured myself a bottle of whiskey and began reading this book, which was by a man called John Marsh, and it was called Skeleton Coast, and it was the story of a shipwreck which had occurred in 1942 on the Skeleton Coast of what was then Southwest Africa, which is now Namibia. And it was an extraordinary story of heroism and I won't go into it in great detail, other than perhaps at the end of this I'll tell you what happened, but it made me think that one day I should actually bestir myself and go and see the wreck of this ship, which I knew still stood on the Skeleton Coast, and that therefore that would be the vehicle that I would use to propel me, as it were, across the Atlantic and galvanize me into writing the book. And so effectively, I did. I made the decision there and then that I would write this book about the Atlantic, but born of the idea from this book, The Skeleton Coast, which I began reading at about 10 o'clock that night and was so fascinated by that when I finished the book, dawn was coming up over the Andes. It just took the whole night, and it just as if the night was no time at all. It was such an extraordinarily good story. So I came back to New York, and I put the idea to my publishers that I would write a book about the Atlantic. But how on earth do you do it? Well, it became clear to me after a little while of thinking that the Atlantic is an entity that can reasonably be said to have a life, certainly a lifespan, and that it was born at a definable time in world history, about 200 million years ago. And if you believe the geological futurologists who mainly inhabit the University of Texas, but they're sensible fellows. They're mathematical modelers that, I mean, despite living in Texas, that they have looked at how continents have moved in the past, and they've drawn up algorithms which show how they'll move in the future. And they've proved, at least to their contentment, that the Atlantic will cease to be in another 170 million years' time. And of course, we'll all be well extinct by that time. And actually, that allows me to ruminate very briefly on the whole concept of geological time, which some people just don't get. There was a classic example 3 or 4 years ago. I was talking to a group of ladies who lunch in Kansas City, I think it was, about the Yellowstone volcano complex, which is at some time in the future going to re-erupt. And when it does so, it'll be several hundred years of eruptions, which will have an extraordinary effect on the cities, including San Francisco, but also Portland and Seattle and Vancouver and Calgary. They will be buried under 100 or 200 feet of volcanic ash and will effectively, that'll be the end. I mean, the northwest of the United States will be toast, there's no doubt about it. But everyone was sort of nervous about this, and I said, well, don't worry, because, I mean, we're talking geological time here, and there's 250,000 years at least, by which time, of course, everyone will be extinct. And everyone sort of seemed rather relieved to hear this, except one extremely angry woman in the front row who stood up brandishing her program, very red-faced, and she said, what? She said, what? Even Americans will be extinct? So they will be then, and they'll certainly be in 170 million years' time. So the Atlantic, therefore, has a total lifespan of, let's say, well, nearly 400 million years from its birth 200 million years ago to its likely death 170 or 180 million years' time. And then sandwiched almost in the middle is a very slender period, at least slender geologically, of about 200,000 years when humankind is involved in the ocean. And that's really the core of the book. And the big question was how on earth to write that. Because that doesn't in the same sense have a lifespan. So I was flying across the Atlantic one day from, I think, New York to London, and like most people, just sort of drumming my fingers on the armrest, thinking, when is this going to be over? Because I think the flights have now reduced the Atlantic to just a sort of tedious, incommoding expanse of distance. You look at that little map and the seat back in front of you and you think, oh my God, you know, we're just between Greenland and Newfoundland. Why can't we get there? And we forget the extraordinary romance and all the stories that went on in the ocean that's 5 miles below us. And I happened to be reading, because I was bored, an anthology of poetry by David Owen, who was the former British Foreign Secretary, Lord Owen now. And it was called Seven Ages. He had organized all the poetry that he'd liked according to the Seven Ages of Man from Shakespeare's As You Like It, All the World's a Stage and All the Men and Women Merely Players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, the acts being seven ages. And those seven ages, I'm sure you will remember it from school, are infant, schoolchild, lover, soldier, justice, old man, and return to childhood. And it seemed, it came sort of in a flash that I could organize all the information I was beginning to find about the Atlantic Ocean and corral it into these seven categories. So, for instance, everything to do with war, from the Vikings to the Romans to the, you know, the wooden-walled battleships to the steel-walled battleships, and including slavery and piracy and all the nastiness, that could go into Chapter 4, the soldier chapter, whereas the lover chapter would be everything about our romantic appreciation of the ocean, so the poetry, the music, the architecture, the literature, the painting, and so on and so forth. So that was the structure that I adopted for the book. And thus far, I seem to have dodged the bullet in terms of critique, because, you know, you think some people might think that using Shakespeare, who'd after all never been to sea in his life, never, far as we know, saw a boat, you know, that he produces the structure for a book about the ocean is a bit of a stretch, but thus far people have been generally rather kind. So I thought what I'd do today was to pluck almost at random just one story from this great sort of gallimaufry of stories that I've tried to hammer into these seven categories to give you an indication of the sort of wealth of material that I had. I was really blessed. There's such a lot going on in the ocean, and so if I had longer, and maybe something will come out in the question period, some of the stories about the Atlantic are extremely important. You know, the birth of democracy, because it was born in the Atlantic. The state of Israel was unexpectedly born in the Atlantic. The container ship was born in the Atlantic. Telegraphy, cables, galleons, all sorts of things born in the Atlantic. But this story is completely pointless. It has no importance at all, but it's just vaguely amusing as an Atlantic story. It takes place in the far north of the Atlantic, on the Faroe Islands. Now, the Faroe Islands, maybe some of you have been there. To me, unutterably beautiful. They're up very high latitude, about 62 degrees north, so it's cold and foggy, rainy, stormy, the kind of place that Englishmen love going on holidays. 50,000 people live on these 18 islands which belong to Denmark. And these 50,000 people are essentially genetically Vikings. The language, the Faroese, is essentially the last sort of linguistic bastion of the Viking language. And as you may remember, the Vikings are big chaps, the men are, and their career seems to have been, you know, rape, sacking and pillage, and they did that for many hundreds of years. But the Faroes are at war today with nobody. It's a totally peaceful part of the world. And the consequence is that the Viking men have a superabundance of testosterone, and they're not at having fights with anybody. But they do manage to get this testosterone out of their systems by a rather peculiar thing that they do, which I came across when I first went there. The topography of the Faroes, of these 18 islands, is that they are made of basalt, a volcanic rock, which, you know, Iceland and places like that have heaps of it. And the basalt is tilted about 30 degrees up from west to east, such that each of these 18 islands has very, very steep and high cliffs on the western side. Some of the tallest cliffs in the world, I mean up to 2,000 feet high and almost completely sheer. And then the grass slopes down at about 30 degrees until it bleeds into the ocean on the eastern side. And the action takes place on these cliffs. The cliffs, as I say, they just go up, 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 as far as the eye can see. They have water cascading down them, and they have peppered all over the cliffs these tiny patches, probably maybe five times as big as this podium here, of grass. Vertiginously steep grass, maybe 80 degrees from the horizontal, amazingly steep. And the grass is where the action happens, because what occurs is that each springtime, February, March, young Faroese men with this superabundance of testosterone come in small boats to the base of the cliffs and attempt to leap onto the cliffs, which, as you might imagine, must be washed with the waves, smashing up and down, are covered with seaweed and eelgrass. They're very slimy, very difficult to land on. But they're made easier to land on because for the last many, many decades, fixed ropes have been suspended from the summits all the way down, and there's festooned with these ropes. So if you can imagine the situation, the boat arrives, the bottom of these enormously tall cliffs, the boat going up and down, the waves crashing against the base of the cliffs, young Faroese man, all sort of muscles and bone, attempting to leap onto the cliff, and he judges his moment, and he leaps on and grabs hold of the rope, and more by judgment than luck, he makes it. He's okay. He's not going to drown. So as soon as he's secure, he grabs onto the rope with normally his right hand and reaches back into the boat and pulls from the well of the boat a lamb. The boat turns out to be full of baby lambs. And he takes this lamb and he fixes it very carefully in some sort of traditional way round his neck with its little legs or paws or whatever you call them, sort of tucked into his collar so that the lamb is secure and doesn't, maybe he attaches it with a bit of string or something, but so that it doesn't fall off him. And then he begins to climb up the cliff. So hand over hand, you're 200 feet up, 300, 400, 500, 800 feet up, until down below, I mean, the sea and the boat are down at the bottom of the cliff, and he reaches one of these patches of nearly perfectly steep grass. Grass which, incidentally, is extremely lush and rich because it has been fertilized with guano from the bird that lives on these cliffs, which is the puffin. And I'm sure, as you all probably know, puffin guano is incredibly rich in nitrates and things. And so the grass which grows on these cliffs is very, very nutritious. It's merely the inconvenience that it's nearly vertical. So he gets to one of these patches of grass over to his left side or whatever, and holding on for grim death, presumably, with one hand, he takes from his neck this little lamb and he plants it very carefully on this piece of grass. And the lamb, I mean, who knows what goes on in a lamb's head, but it looks down and it sees, crikey, you know, 800 feet below there are rocks and there's waves, and I've got to arrange my feet in such a way that I don't fall off. And so the lamb at first is panic-stricken and nearly does fall off, but very solicitously our Faroese, our Viking, keeps sort of pressing the lamb inwards until after 3 or 4 minutes of very patient attention to the fate of the lamb, the lamb appears to achieve some kind of stability. And the Faroese man takes his hand away and says to the lamb, I wasn't there, so I don't know, I'm just assume from what I've heard, essentially, are you going to be okay? And the lamb gives a little hoof up or thumbs up or whatever it is and remains where he is and does not fall off. Whereupon the Faroese chap goes down the rope and joins his friends and in the boat sails away home. And if you go to any Faroese island cliff in from sort of March throughout the summer, you will see this vision of these black, steep, wet cliffs with these scores of green patches of very, very steep grass. And in the middle of each one of them, a tiny white dot. And if you look through binoculars, you can see it is a lamb, terrified, presumably, hardly moving at all, except other than to wolf down as much of this puffin guano-enriched grass as he possibly can. And then we get to the point at the end of the season, September, October, where the reverse happens. The Faroese man now comes back to the cliff, having failed to go to war with anyone during the summer. He's still now built up another superabundance of testosterone. He shins up the cliff again, and he gets to his patch of grass, and he finds no longer is there a lamb there, but there is an enormous sheep that has been patiently eating grass, doesn't run around or gamble because there's no room to do so, and so he's fat and happy. And, well, I'd love to be able to say that the Faroese man is a compassionate individual who tries to put this sheep round his shoulder, but it would be entirely impractical. So he does precisely the converse of what he did at the beginning. Instead of putting his hand on the outside of the sheep, he puts his hand on the inside of the sheep, between the sheep and the mountain face, and with a backwards jerk, he knocks the sheep off the cliff and it goes down, splashes with an enormous splash into the ocean, a third of a mile or a fifth of a mile below. And apparently, I know it sounds a sort of Monty Python-esque situation, but you should not go sailing around the cliffs of the Faroe Islands in September or October for fear of falling sheep. They are raining down in huge numbers. So then he comes down to the bottom of the cliff, joins his chums in the boat, fishes this sodden and usually rather dead animal out of the water, takes it back to Tórshavn, butchers it, and dines on what is said to be the most nutritious and luscious lamb in all the world. Now, I could tell you far more important stories than that, full of portent and significance about the future of democracy, the future of Israel, trade patterns, the Hanseatic League, piracy, whatever, but I thought that this would at least amuse you as being a trivially unimportant story that I discovered from the Atlantic. So thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Have a seat, Mr. Winchester.
Thank you. So much water. It's rather like the Atlantic Ocean here.
Well, we thought it would fit in with the theme of the evening.
Indeed.
And speaking of the theme of the evening, of course, we are, having questions from the audience inside the auditorium, and one of the most recurring questions is, and it's the same thing that occurred to me, which is of literally a universe of topics that you can embark upon before you set upon the monumental task of facing the blank screen. How do you figure out what topic you're going to cover next?
Well, I know what topic I'm going to cover next in my life, which is America. I become an American citizen in a matter of weeks, and that's what I want to do next. But how one segues from one book to another, you just sort of keep in the back of your mind ideas that you think you'd like to do. And as I explained from the failure of the Pacific book, the Atlantic had always been something I wanted to do. And thanks to John Marsh's book, there was the trigger which pushed me over the edge. So there's always a sort of... Well, I remember when I was a small boy, there were advertisements you'd see in the Daily Telegraph newspaper advertising a course for something called Pelmanism. And I'm never quite sure what Pelmanism is, but always at the top it says, "Do you have a grasshopper mind?" And my father would say, you've got a grasshopper mind. You should take Pelmanism. Well, I didn't take the course, and the grasshopper remains, and he leads me to things like the Atlantic.
Okay. But, I mean, really, do you ever get in the middle of a massive project and think, okay, this is a dead end?
I have done in the past, and there are, I think, three contracts for books that I started and never finished. One was a big book on Manchuria, which everyone said was the cockpit of all the world's wars. And honestly, I got into it. And anyway, I had to give them all the money back and say, I'm not going to do that. Then there was a French mathematician called Évariste Galois, who I wanted to write a book about, but that didn't work out. And finally, a book about Shanghai, huge competition for writing books about Shanghai. And I had started on this one, and suddenly an immensely large and brilliant book about Shanghai came up. And I thought, there's no point in me doing it. So yes, there have been three sort of things that went on.
Okay, so there's the occasional blind alley.
There most certainly is.
And it's at this point when I have to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with journalist, broadcaster, and best-selling author Simon Winchester. I'm Brian Hackney, and to get to some of the things that may or may not be of more weightiness than the puffin guano, tell me about, to begin, in the middle of nowhere with this, one of the chapters of the book is dedicated to warfare on the open sea, and you had your own personal experience with it. So let's go back to early May 1982.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what time frame we're in and what's happening and what happened to you.
Well, I had been in March, of 82, I'd been in India doing a story in Simla in the Himalayas when I got a telegram. This was in the days when telegrams were common, from my foreign editor in London, saying, return to London immediately. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is a problem with my expenses, which is... And so I came down to Delhi that night. I took the British Airways flight from Delhi to London, turned up, Cal McChrystal, his name was, and I said, Cal, what's the problem? He said, oh, there's no problem at all. We just thought that there's going to be a war in the South Atlantic, we think, between Argentina and Britain over the Falkland Islands. And we think you should be the chap to go. So I always had a bag packed, and I took it down, flew to Buenos Aires, and I knew one friend of mine from school who was a spy at the British Embassy in Buenos Aires. And I went to have lunch with him, and I said, are the Argentines going to invade the Falklands? And he said, well, I can't possibly tell you, but I can tell you this. You can probably get a flight to the Falklands, but you may not get one back. And that was nod is as good as a wink to a blind horse, they say. So I flew down to southern Patagonia, a place called Comodoro Rivadavia, took the flight to the Falkland Islands. The Falklands were invaded 2 days later, so I was there hiding under the governor's bed when the Argies were machine gun. It was all very exciting. And then the governor was deported. I was deported about 3 days later and then arrested for spying because they found the telephone number of the spy in my notebook. And
Where were you arrested?
In a place called Ushuaia, which is the most southerly town in the world, actually. It's now a rather ritzier place used as a stepping-off place for tourist boats going to the Antarctic.
And what were you doing when you were arrested? Were you having coffee?
I was having coffee, actually. Well, a glass of wine, I should think, more like. And there were three of us. There was a chap from The Observer and a photographer I didn't know, the Observer fellow, who's called Ian Mather. He and I had been in the Lebanon 6 weeks previously in Beirut, because this was at the time of the Civil War. So it had been a fairly active year already, and so suddenly here we are under arrest, and we are tried, sentenced to life imprisonment for spying, and put in the slammer in this town, Ushuaia. Well, that was all quite amusing, I suppose. But there was the day that you're referring to, and that's the background, is when there was a sudden commotion, 10th of May, and the governor of the prisoner, a man called Juan Carlos Grieco, came running up to the cell and said, oh, Senor Winchester, Senor Mather, great victory today. We, Argentina, have sunk one of your warships. And indeed they had, and it's one of the events that all Britons remember where they were, when the first warship of ours of the Royal Navy sunk since World War II, it was a destroyer called HMS Sheffield, had been sunk by an Argentine missile dropped from a French, typical French, perfidious France, aeroplane. So we lost a ship, and he was exultant, and it was a terrible tragedy. But the coda to that story was about 15 years later, I got a letter from Juan Carlos sent through an intermediary saying he wanted to see me. And
suffice it to say, you did not spend life in prison.
No. We were released once the British won the war, and we were part of sort of the tidying up of. In fact, we were released to keep Argentina's face. We weren't actually exonerated. We were released on bail, and I might say an insultingly small sum. So Juan Collas wrote to me, and he told me what had happened to him. He had been arrested, dismissed from the Navy, arrested, put in my cell for a year, went because the regime changed so dramatically. He then went selling soap door to door in Buenos Aires for 6 years, but managed to keep his family together and his dignity, and then went back to university, took a degree in history, and was now lecturer in history in the Tierra del Fuego campus of the University of Patagonia. And he wanted to see me very much because he wanted to say something to me, but was there any way I could come back to Patagonia? So I showed this letter to an editor in New York. He said, well, wonderful story. So I flew down that day from back to Buenos Aires, then down to Ushuaia, and there was Juan Carlos, and it was amazing. I'm in tears, and he was very tearful about this. British, we don't do that sort of thing. We went off, well, it's not entirely true, but we went to a restaurant, and we ate the Centosia with this famous king crab they have down there, and ate a souffle. I remember vividly of what are called the calafate berries, which are, they say about the calafate fruit, if you eat it, you will always come back to Patagonia. And I love Patagonia. It's a wonderful part of the world. But then he got very sort of lachrymose, and we were drinking Malbec, I think, again. And he said, I want to say something about that night I came into your cell, exultant about the sinking of HMS Sheffield. I am a sailor, he said, and I would never wish on anybody to die alone at sea in the middle of the ocean with your ship sinking beside you. And I want to apologize formally for what I said, because, he said, there is a brotherhood of the sea and all sailors stick together. And I thought that was amazingly touching. Yeah. So we've remained friends ever since.
Good heavens. Wow, your former jailer. I want to cover some of the basics of, the ocean. So let's do it in fairly rapid-fire fashion. How long has it been around?
200 million years.
When was the first time humans said, I'm going to go and float on that thing?
164,000 years is when we first saw it in southern Africa and had our first seafood. And the evidence in this cave called PP13B at a place called Pinnacle Point is that they did not follow G.K. Chesterton's dictum that it was a brave man who ate the first oyster, because they dined on oysters. So the first seafood meal was what you can get at Tadish's Grill, oysters.
Okay. Who were the first people who regularly set sail upon it?
The Phoenicians, and that was in about the 7th century BC, and they did so in an extraordinary act of bravery, going through the Pillars of Hercules from the safety of the Mediterranean, sailing between Gibraltar and Jebel Musa, out into this ocean that Homer had called the Sea of Perpetual Gloom, that was full of monsters and storms and possibly the edge of the world, if you believed that the world was not spherical. But they turned left, they found that they didn't sink, and they discovered two islands off what is now the Moroccan port of Essaouira, where there were a huge number of these shells called Murex brandaris, from which they already knew in the Mediterranean they could extract a beautiful, indelible purple dye, which the Roman and Greek aristocracies liked to dye their clothes with. And so they set up a trading post. And so that was the beginning of Atlantic trade. It began, market forces what dragged us into the Atlantic.
Okay, more than 2,500 years ago.
Yeah.
But these people generally sailed within sight of land.
They did, until the seminal moment was 1001 AD. And I'm going to get into terrible trouble with particularly, I'll never get a restaurant reservation at an Italian restaurant again, because I try in this book to knock Christopher Columbus from his perch.
Oh, you succeed.
I think most people, well, I hope so, but you've got the District of Columbia, Columbus, Ohio. I mean, America, every child is taught. 1492, he sailed the ocean blue and all of that. Well, he may have done, but he wasn't the first to do so. The first was 491 years before. It was this very nice chap called Leif Erikson, who imprisoned no one, enslaved nobody. He behaved in a civilized fashion, built a settlement, which still exists now in a place called Lanso Meadows in the north of Newfoundland, and had cattle and performed agriculture and conceived, and there was a child born. The first, I love this story, the first European child ever born in North America was born in Newfoundland in 1002 AD, and he has this wonderful name. He was called Snorri Thorfinnsson. And the only big difference between Ericsson up north and Columbus down south is that the weather up north was dreadful, cold and rainy, and the Norwegians thought, why are we staying here, and legged it back to Norway after about eight years, whereas Columbus's people, you know, it was benign and sunny, and there were nice sort of places to grow lots of plants and vegetables and things, and they stayed. And that's a pure difference of geography and latitude.
Now, I have to ask you, because I loved the story about, certainly for a long time we did think it was Columbus, and then that changed, and it changed not that long ago. What was that compelling bit of evidence that provided humankind with the knowledge that, yes, they were here almost 500 years before Columbus? What did they discover?
Well, it was the discovery of the settlement, and it was an extraordinary moment. I mean, you had these two archaeologists from Norway who believed on the evidence of a map that they had seen that Erik the Red's son, Leif Erikson, had got there. But there was no real evidence that he'd got there. And so year after year, they would come back to various tempting-looking bays and inlets, mainly in Newfoundland and Labrador. And then one day in 1960, and you're right, I mean, it's very, very recent, they asked a farmer, as they had asked every previous season, is there anything which could be an old settlement? And this farmer said, what took you so long? Yes, there is. Over that field yonder, there is this series of bumps, which I know hides a settlement, something. It's clearly artificial. And so these two somewhat skeptical Norwegians walked over the fields through the cloudberries and the little stunted brush, and there were these lumps. And they started very carefully digging away, and they found sod-covered houses with little doors and little windows, which had been there for the previous 1,000 years. And this was the first ever human settlement in North America, an incredible moment. The National Geographic then got wind of it and sponsored the remainder of the expeditions and the excavation of a site which now is administered by Parks Canada. And to me, it's one of the most significant of all the parks in North America, because this is where we began, where the European story of North America started.
In your research, I know that you can't interview Leif Erikson, but what kind of a person did it take to lose sight of land and go sailing off into that unknown?
Well, I think...
And when did it happen?
Well, it happened in 1001, and before that, other sailors that we know of, because they kept journals, had also lost sight of land, trying to get a sort of into the Atlantic. They couldn't say across because they didn't know there was another side. But St. Brendan is a classic example from Ireland in the 6th century. They went up the coast of Ireland. They lost sight of land once they passed north of Inishtrahull, and there was Scotland some way off to the east of them. They made it up to the Faroe Islands, and they made it up to Iceland. And some people, I mean, Tim Severin, who built a replica of St. Brendan's boat, did actually make it to Newfoundland, but there is no evidence that St. Brendan himself did. But these people, I mean, just imagine, put yourself in the shoes of, or the boats, the very tiny, I mean, the St. Brendan's boat was a leather-covered, leather and ashwood boat. The Atlantic Ocean is a big, powerful, storm-ridden, gigantic waves up in the north, icebergs, ice flows. It's not a pretty place, and to set off, no idea where you're going to, how easy it'll be to turn around if you get nowhere. I mean, it was terrifying. They must have been truly remarkable men.
Yeah. And how long did it take from the time that we did lose sight of the coastline to make war on the ocean?
Ah, to make war? Well, not too long. I mean, once, and we have to fast forward, there was effectively no war in the North Atlantic, aside from the coastal conflicts involving the Vikings and so forth. From 1001 to 1492, we were busy with other things. But then the Turks blocked entry to the spice routes going eastwards, forcing Europeans to say, well, if we need our spices, if we need our pepper and our mace and our nutmeg and so forth, we're going to have to see if we can go west about to get them because the Turks won't let us go east about. And that was what prompted Columbus's expedition, of course, the need to go and find the Spice Islands, notably the Bandar Islands. But, of course, he didn't find them because, inconveniently in his way, was this entity which nobody knew about called North America. But the moment that was settled, and we're talking now about the very end of the 15th century and when it had been given the name America by Amerigo Vespucci, and when the first map had been drawn, this map with the word America on it, designed in Freiburg by this man called Martin Waldseemüller, which America now owns, bought by the Library of Congress, because the Librarian of Congress quite rightly said, this is America's birth certificate, which I thought was a very clever way of putting it, or persuading the taxpayer to pony up 10 million bucks. Once that had been realized, once settlement began, once trade began, then inevitably war begins, and you get the wars that, well, you get piracy, then you get wars between nations, initially fought within sight of land, which is why battles like the Battle of Trafalgar are named for the land that you could see, but then from the ships, but then once, you know, the whole business of longitude had been sorted out, then ships could find themselves and their enemies in fleets in the middle of the ocean without being able to see, have landmarks. And then battles started to be fought in the middle of the ocean. And then, of course, they started to be fought between steel-hulled ships, the first one being the Merrimack and the Monitor over here during the American Civil War, and then mighty battles between huge steel-walled ship fleets like the Battle of Jutland in 1916. So as a proving ground for war, there's no other ocean like it.
Do you have, over this vast landscape, seascape
I guess,
of battles out on the Atlantic Ocean, do you have a favorite? I mean, from the Spanish Armada, I know the Falklands have a personal place in your own personal experience.
Well, I like wars that we won, I suppose. But no, I think the classic of all battles is Trafalgar, where Nelson, I mean, heroically, I mean, up to that point, lines of battle, wooden warships, they attended to each other as two parallel lines and then fired their broadsides at each other, attempting to break the masts and the spars and the sails. But Nelson had this brilliant idea of turning into the what's called crossing the T. And by doing that, he split the French and the Spanish fleets into two, and it's a much bigger fleet than his, but managed to bring it to submission. And, of course, he died in the attempt, most famously, and Nelson's the day of his death is the most holy day in British naval history. But that was a seminal battle, yes.
Isn't there a relic of Nelson's own that's on display? Tell us about that.
Yes, I mean, in the Greenwich Museum in on the Thames mouth east of London, there is many things, including John Harrison's chronometer, the one that enabled him to, the very accurate clock that eventually, as Dava Sobel said in her wonderful book, Longitude, showed how a sailor could compute time accurately on board ship and therefore, or thereby, compute his longitude. Terribly important. So that's a very important thing in Greenwich. But symbolically and romantically, there is Nelson's uniform with the bullet hole in the breast where that lucky French marksman shot him down at his moment of victory. And I might say, interestingly, that his flagship was HMS Victory, which was brought back to Portsmouth and is to this day in dry dock in Portsmouth in southern England, the oldest commissioned warship in the world because it still is commissioned. But in America, there is the oldest floating commissioned warship in the world, which is a USS Constitution, which is in floating in Boston Harbor and very occasionally moves. There is a move at the moment by the American government to put it in dry dock because of its costs. And I pray, I know obviously everyone these days is saving money, but I think it's terribly important that the Constitution, which after all is going to become, everyone's going to know about it in 2 years' time because it'll be the bicentenary of the War of 1812, we must keep this beautiful ship afloat, not least because it's going to be on the deck of that ship that I take my ceremony to become an American. So it's enlightened self-interest here.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with journalist, broadcaster, and best-selling author Simon Winchester. I'm Brian Hackney. And before we leave the topic of war on the briny deep completely behind, we're reminded hourly of the existence of Israel for one reason or another. and Israel may, through an interesting connection, partially owe its existence to something that had to do with the Atlantic.
It is extraordinary, really. Basically, in 1916, the Royal Navy was losing the Battle of the Atlantic because we had run out of cordite with which to shoot German submarines. This was in the days when German submarines would fire their torpedoes from the surface. We ran out of cordite because we'd run out of a chemical called acetone, which ladies used these days for removing nail polish, I think. Well, as it happens, every Tuesday in Manchester, in England, the editor of the Manchester Guardian, the paper I used to work for, a chap called C.P. Scott, would have lunch with someone he found interesting. And one day in August, I think it was, 1916, he had lunch with the professor of biology at the University of Manchester, who was a white Russian called Chaim Weizmann. And Weizmann said, among other things, I've developed a new technique of making acetone. I mean, C.P. Scott had never heard of acetone, was very uninterested in this revelation. But the following week, he had lunch with David Lloyd George, who was the Minister of Munitions in the British War Cabinet. Lloyd George said, we've run out of cordite, we can't fire our guns because we haven't got any of this stuff called acetone. And a light went on in Scott's head. And he said, I've heard this word acetone earlier in the week. There's this funny little fellow who is the professor of biology who says he can make it. Really? Let's have him down to London. So he came down to London and said what he wanted, which was a factory. They gave him the Nicholson's Gin factory, which had just gone bankrupt and which the government owned, and huge quantities of horse chestnuts, which children collected throughout September and October that year, poured into the hoppers of this gin factory, and using Weizmann's magic, a torrent of acetone poured out of the stopcocks, which was loaded into carboys, sent down to the ammunition factory in Dorset, put on the ships, the guns started firing again, the submarines started sinking, the whole calculus of the war in the Atlantic changed in Britain's favour. Come the spring of 1917, the British government said, well, we ought to give thanks to this nice man, Mr. Weizmann, whoever he is, but because he's a foreigner, we've asked the British Foreign Secretary, a man called Arthur Balfour, to offer him the knighthood. So Weizmann came down to London. Balfour, who knew him a bit, said, Professor Weizmann, it's really nice of you to have done this. Thank you very much, and we'd like to make you Sir Chaim Weizmann. And Weizmann said, no, I don't want an honour, but as you well know, I'm the secretary of the English League of Zionists. I would like it if you would write a declaration saying that His Majesty's government would look with favour on the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. And Balfour said, I think I can probably do that, and so talked to his cabinet colleagues. And finally, on November the 17th, I think it was 1917, sending the principal letter to Lord Rothschild, who was the head of the World Zionist Federation, with a copy to Chaim Weizmann out of gratitude for what he had done with producing acetone, the famous Balfour Declaration was written, saying His Majesty's government looks with favour upon the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. And then 31 years later, the State of Israel was born due to chemistry and the Atlantic Ocean.
All because of acetone.
It's an extraordinary thought, all because of nail polish remover.
All because of nail polish remover.
And a gin factory.
Yeah. It may say something about, or it may not, say something about our own, you know, what captivates us these days, that one of the leading cultural icons is named Lady Gaga. But I would have to think that the news of the Atlantic Ocean had to have reached most of Europe somehow. Did people suddenly or gradually become aware of the fact that there is this ocean lying out to their west, and were they gripped by the idea of this vast body of water?
Well, at first they were terrified because they didn't know that it had an end to it. They didn't know there was another side. And so if you look at all, for instance, their poetry and their art, it all reflects the ideas that were full of monsters. I mean, for instance, there was one extraordinary monster called Naglfla, I think it was, which was a ship made of the toe and fingernail clippings of dead seamen. I mean, people had really strange imaginations about the kind of thing that went on in the Atlantic Ocean. So the early poetry reflects that. And then come, I mean, the very first poem was it's found in a beautiful book, Anglo-Saxon book, called the Exeter Book, Exeter Codex, which is in Exeter Cathedral. It's called The Seafarer, and it's all about the terror of the seas and the longing for land. Land was comfort and sanctuary and beauty. But then slowly, once the galleon trade had begun, once people began to get a handle on the ocean and realized it was full of dangers, it needed to be respected, but was not full of monsters, and it wasn't where we fell off the end of the earth, then we started to have a much more lyrical appreciation of the sea. And this appears in, for instance, paintings. I mean, you get these wonderful Winslow Homer, I mean, one of the greatest marine artists of all time, working up in Prout's Neck in Maine, J.M.W. Turner, of course, and the great sea paintings as well. So it's an interesting evolution to see how our love affair with the sea has grown in concert with our commercial use of it.
And another thing that the Atlantic was one of the great milestones was that it was literally a conduit for conveying information. Now, how long, if you and I were around in 1820 and wanted to get word that I had bought a pair of shoes in New York, how long would it have taken word of that to reach London?
Well, I can certainly tell you for 1865, because when Lincoln was assassinated, it took 12 days. Ah. The news was conveyed essentially up to Nova Scotia, then was put on a boat, taken across the ocean to Ireland, and then eventually horses and so forth took the news to London. So, I mean, it was a long time. But then suddenly, this man, Cyrus Field, lived in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, which is more or less where I live, he came up with the idea that the telegraph, which had been newly invented, could, if you know, made of properly constructed cables, could be allowed to run under the ocean. And they tried, and they failed many, many times, until someone had the bright idea of putting about 2,000 miles of cable on one ship and 2,000 miles of cable on another, the two ships meeting in the middle of the Atlantic, splicing the two ends of the cables together in mid-Atlantic, and then moving away from one another. And by doing that, with one ship ending up at a place called Foilhamerun Bay near Galway in Ireland, and the other one at a place called Heart's Content in Newfoundland, a cable unbroken, now connected. And the Queen sent a message to the American president saying that the old world and the new world are now one. We are united. That cable only lasted for about a week, but it was rebuilt 5 or 6 years later. And now, of course, the ocean floor is littered with cables. Right. And then shortly after cables came radio communication.
I was going to say, the cables were made obsolete fairly quickly.
Well, not totally obsolete, because
so
they're very secure. I mean, you have fiber optic cables today in vast abundance, but passing a signal through the air. And I just think this is so romantic. Marconi, this half-Irish, half-Italian chap, sitting on a clifftop, Signal Hill above St. John's in Newfoundland, with an aerial on a kite 500 feet above him, in a storm, listening with a man called Mr. Kemp, through his new thing, this radio receiver, listening for what he hoped would be the sound of the Morse code for the letter S, which a bunch of people working for him in Cornwall, 2,000 miles away, had been patiently tapping for the last week, night and day. And you had this marvelous moment that Kemp describes when suddenly this very patient little man suddenly hears a sound in his little receiver, and he hands it to Kemp and says, "Do you hear that, Mr. Kemp?" And over the sounds of the storm and the waves below, the first realization that a sound made by a human 2,000 miles away can be picked up on a machine here in North America. And, of course, that changed everything.
So the first broadcast was the letter S.
The first ever broadcast was indeed the letter S, wow. Yes.
Now, people had some skepticism about whether or not they had heard static or if they heard the real thing. Did anybody throw his weight behind the real thing?
Yes, the person that did down in New Jersey was Edison. He said no. I mean, and then the New York Times, both of them said, this experiment has worked. And because of the cable industry thought this newfangled thing, wireless thing, was just a fiction, all in the imagination. But no, it was quickly pointed out that his technology trumped their technology. And so radio became the thing. And within the following year, there was a radio station built on Cape Cod. And then wireless messages became just a commonplace. And every ship at sea was equipped with a radio. And the rest is quite literally history.
Let's change our attention to natural phenomena in the Atlantic Ocean. Of all of the natural phenomena, tsunamis, hurricanes, eddies, currents, do you have a favorite?
Well, I think the dominant thing is the Gulf Stream, of course, which Ben Franklin drew the first map of. I mean, a wonderful map. He was intrigued by the fact that the mail boats, because if you remember, he was the first U.S. Postmaster General and was a colonial postmaster. He wanted to know why the mail packets going from Falmouth to Halifax were battling against the seas in a way that the ships coming back were not, and how it was that a ship coming eastbound would go much more quickly if it headed north and was taken off by this stream. And so he plotted a map of this great big 60-mile-wide current that came from Florida, warm water coming all the way to Scotland. And I used to live in Scotland, and you know, you're way up at 58 degrees north latitude, when at 58 north degrees in this part of the world, it's bitterly cold. We grow palm trees at the bottom of our garden because the water that washes at the bottom of our the house I used to have comes from Florida, courtesy of the Gulf Stream. And in fact, 30 or so years ago, when I was a small boy, someone experimented by dumping many tons of perfume into the Gulf Stream off Orlando. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, people in Scotland would say, "What's that dreadful smell?" And it was the perfume.
Okay, and so this was quite a this was a revelation at the time.
A revelation for navigators and
how did it change navigation?
Well, because it enabled sailors, particularly, to choose prudent routes to go most quickly across the ocean. So it could either be a help or a hindrance if you knew where they were. And so this brought on board the map makers, the most famous American, a chap called Matthew Fontaine Maury, who mapped the currents and the undersea topography of the ocean. So the learning about the currents was crucially important to navigation.
Okay. And not distantly connected to natural phenomenon, what is the state of the Atlantic Ocean today, environmentally, with regard to fishing, perhaps with regard to global warming? How does it look now?
Well, it's not in good shape. I mean, we at the same time of flying across the ocean and being bored by it, we have... It's the pond. We disrespect it. I mean, the British government, the innumerable tons of radioactive material that it just dumped off Cornwall and Ireland and Scotland because they think, you know, it's big enough, it'll absorb it, it'll dilute it. Not at all. I mean, there's tons of radioactivity in the Eastern Atlantic. There's mercury, of course, in tuna. You should never, never eat bluefin tuna. It's an endangered fish. It's also a very dangerous fish to eat. So my wife, who's Japanese, gets very cross with me because, of course, like most Japanese, she likes sushi. But not bluefin tuna sushi, please. But also, I thought one of the most sad examples of human greed and politics was what happened to the codfish off Newfoundland, off the Grand Banks. I mean, here you have, you know, people used to say, I mean, Rudyard Kipling in Captain's Courageous would say that you could almost walk to Newfoundland on the backs of these magnificent silvery fish. There were so many of them. But now, thanks to some appallingly bad decisions made largely by the Canadian governments in the 1990s, pandering to the voters in Newfoundland, there are no cod left. It's a completely cod-free part of the world. Whereas down in the other end of the ocean, there's a fish called the Patagonian toothfish, which we know on our restaurant menus as the Chilean sea bass, because no one's going to eat something called the Patagonian toothfish. That is in good shape because the governments down there have administered that fishery very well. But codfish is a great maritime tragedy.
I'm going to just switch gears to touch on some of your former works quickly, because there's something I really want to know after reading the book. Of all of the anecdotes associated with the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, do you have a favorite? A favorite? Gee, this was weird.
Golly.
There's a lot
thinking
to choose
there's
from.
An awful lot. I mean, I to this day, I keep getting letters from people, you know, my grandmother survived such and such. I love the fact that Ansel Adams, the shape of his nose, his great hawk-like nose, derived from the fact that he was thrown over and hit his nose on a brick wall in San Francisco and broke his nose as a little boy. I like that thought, that this man's distinctive profile was born out of a disaster that he was never able to photograph.
Yeah, and similarly with Krakatoa, your great book on Krakatoa.
Well, and it's the thing about Krakatoa is that it's burbling away again, and I have to Anak Krakatoa. I mean, all the news at the moment is of the eruption of Merapi, but Anak Krakatoa is misbehaving, as it will continue to do. But the thing about Anak Krakatoa is very different from Krakatoa, the mothership, insofar as if it is erupting all the time, it's acting as a safety valve, where if it's plugged up, as Krakatoa was in 1883, then the pressure builds up and builds up and builds up until there is a titanic explosion, which is what happened on the 27th of August, and is what's happening on another sphere of geology with the San Andreas Fault, of course, that the pressure on that is building up and building up and building up, and it will not be long before it ruptures again,
right?
I'm sorry to say.
Is that one of the reasons why you made the transition from geology into journalism, was maybe a fascination with these sorts of, you know, Earth-sized phenomena, these great disasters, or no?
I don't think so, no. I mean, when I left to become a journalist because of this extraordinary friend of mine called James Morris, who then went and changed sex, which was a rather unusual thing to do, but... And indeed...
I sense another book.
Well but the editor of The Guardian said later to anyone wanting to be a journalist, you have to do two things. You have to, first of all, take a degree in geology and then make good friends with a transsexual. No, I think my intention was simply I liked wandering around the world with a pen and pencil and a notebook rather than with a hammer. I wasn't very good at doing that. And I only came back to geology 20 or 30 years later.
Okay. Now, we've gone from the making of the Oxford English Dictionary to Krakatoa, San Francisco earthquake. How many books have you written?
I think it's 21.
What's next?
Well, because of becoming an American, I very much wanted to write a book about America, because I love this country. I know it sounds a corny thing to say, but I mean, despite the vicissitudes of modern-day politics, I have enormous faith in this country, and it's gone through bad times before. I mean, any country that enforces prohibition must be said to have gone through a pretty bad time. unimaginable to most Europeans, you know. So there have been worse moments. But I adore this country, and I want to write a book about a number of people who, as it were, knitted this country together. So I'm making a lot of long journeys in the footsteps of going from the obvious ones of Lewis and Clark right through to modern people like Tom MacDonald, who was the early architect of the interstate highway system, looking at the people who laid the first cables, the first railways, the first canals that allowed commerce between the Gulf of Mexico and the Great Lakes, and the first geological survey and so forth. And my wife came up with the title. I just think it's amazing that the title has never been used, but I'm delighted it hasn't, which is going to be The Men Who United the States.
It's very nice. Titles are very important. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for two last questions. I'm going to be the author of these questions. Forgive my juvenile interest in this sort of thing, but is there any natural phenomenon from the Atlantic to earthquakes to volcanoes that you wish you could have been standing in a safe place to watch unfold?
I would love to, but this is going to be a terrible thing to say in Northern California, but I'd love to be in a big earthquake, but safely. I mean, I was in Christchurch, New Zealand recently when there was that big earthquake. And I mean, this is all meat and drink to people here in this audience, but I had never really been in a room when suddenly the room started to shake uncontrollably, and that was amazing. And I was glad to have experienced that, but it's given me a taste for an even bigger one.
So you're going to be moving to the Bay Area then, I understand.
Maybe. Oakland to be the place to be, I think. Oakland,
yeah.
And Berkeley.
Well, this puts you in good company, though, because I do recall one of the great stories of the 1906 earthquake was
a chap who very much wanted to, all his life, he wanted to experience an earthquake, and he had a pencil and a notebook beside his bed, and finally he got it, and it was happening, and he was able to stand up and stagger over the room while all this was happening. So he got it, and I want it.
Yeah. Who was that again, the guy who photographed?
I can't remember this minute.
I'm sure there are many people listening who do. I know it wasn't Andrew Lawson. It was the guy who went out and photographed the fault.
Yes.
And it's escaping my head. The last question. Mr. Winchester, somewhere in the midnight of your soul...
Golly.
Now, I know that you want to... An earthquake is not uncommon. There's the chance, it could happen before the program's over, that we could actually experience one. That's not going to happen, don't worry. But is there something... See, this is what I would find frustrating about being a geologist. You have to wait so long for something to happen.
Well, it depends where you live, of course.
Yes.
If you live in Petrolia, California, there are about 20 every day.
Right, yeah. Not sizable, though.
No, this is true.
Is there some significant big that, unfortunately, there would be a cost both in human and property damage, but is there some physical phenomenon outside of earthquakes that you would really love to see happen in our lifetime?
Golly, that is an awful question in all sorts of ways. But I tell you the thing. Okay, let me answer it completely in the reverse. There, many people will have heard this story, and I think it was on a BBC documentary, that there will be an eruption of a volcano called the Cumbre Vieja volcano in the Canary Islands, which will cause the detachment of an enormous chunk of rock, which, if it falls into the Atlantic Ocean, will cause a tsunami which will engulf New York City. This is complete nonsense. It is not true. The volcano is not going to do as it's suggested. And the BBC got itself into a lot of hot water when it was discovered that the documentary alleging this was actually underwritten by a big Chicago-based reinsurance company.
Ladies and gentlemen, the disaster that will never happen. Our thanks to Simon Winchester, journalist, broadcaster, and best-selling author.
Thank you very much.
Tonight's program was presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium and underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We also thank our audience here and on the radio. I'm Brian Hackney. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Well done. Thank you very much.